Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Zan Brooks. On the show this week, Jason Solomons meets Claire Danes, best known for her role as a star-crossed lover in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, but now playing alongside high school Muppet Zac Efron in Me and Orson Welles. This week sees the release of Disgrace, starring John Malkovich. I talk to director Steve Jacobs from Sydney about South African politics and the perils of shunting a big novel to the big screen. And Peter Bradshaw joins me to review some of the week's other big releases, including Cameron Diaz in The Box and Steven Soderbergh's The Girlfriend Experience. Yes, it's as precious as Rosebud and as enigmatic as The Third Man. It's Film Weekly.
I can't even spell ukulele.
Y-O-U-C-A.
It ain't funny, McGee.
No, seriously, why would anybody even play a ukulele in Julius Caesar anyway?
They've got it disguised as a lute. Lucius, that's you, sings Brutus a lullaby right before the final battle.
I'm singing on stage?
Yeah.
Who plays Brutus?
Orson.
Who was playing Lucius before I showed up?
Some kid. He had a personality problem with Orson.
Meaning
he had a personality.
Claire Danes there with Zac Efron, who both star in Richard Linklater's Me and Orson Welles. The tale of a school kid plucked from obscurity to star in Welles' landmark production of Julius Caesar. Set in the late 1930s, when Welles was still a legend in embryo, the film explores the man's magnetic charisma and perhaps his spoilt brat nature too. Jason Solomons met up with Claire Danes to talk about her career to date and her own love of the theatre.
Claire Danes.
Hi.
Lovely to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Congratulations on playing what I think is it's a very difficult role in Me and Orson Welles, because, you know, she's a bit of a kind of apart from everyone. You know what I mean? They're all sort of part of the troupe, and you seem to kind of circle around on the outside.
Right. Yeah. No, she's Orson's Girl Friday, so she's not a creative member of the team. I was very charmed by her, and she's very driven and ambitious, but she's also kind of guileless. I mean, she's very honest and open, and she wants to succeed, but she doesn't mean to undermine anyone else in the process, you know. Mm-hmm.
She's one of those kind of people who's kind of smitten. You get the feeling she'd rather be on stage than kind of sorting out the paperwork backstage.
Well, I don't know. I imagine her ultimate dream would be to produce a movie or something.
That flinty ambition needed. She wants to be on the accepting the Best Picture award from the Academy.
Yeah, I think that's more her style. Yeah.
Is there a bit of you in there? Would you like to produce? Would you like to get involved? You're an actress through and through.
I'm kind of an actress through and through. I'm not that dynamic, unfortunately.
You just got married, did you not?
I did. Yeah.
Congratulations to our own. Yeah. I don't know, I say that you're pilfering. Come over here, take our men.
Yeah.
To Hugh Dancy.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm going back to Orson Welles, but I don't congratulate you on getting married. It's a good thing to do. Where did you meet Hugh Dancy?
We made Evening together. We met then.
The Coltheim, the Lajos Coltheim movie?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's quite amazing. I mention it because obviously you're in a film which is kind of rife with backstage gossip and intrigue and kind of backstage romances. So then you marry an actor and then you see, that happens.
It does. It's fertile ground for that kind of thing.
Yeah, do you think it is the way it's I don't know, there's something, what is it about the charge that was sort of putting on a production that makes all this romance?
Well, it's very difficult to do, to put on a play or film a movie. I mean, people work very passionately, and it's kind of an insular world, and I don't know, people are invested and things happen. Wires are crossed. Anyway.
Are you a theatre practitioner? Do you get to go on stage very much?
Just before I shot Me and Orson Welles, I did my first play. I did Pygmalion on Broadway.
As Liza, I hope.
Yes. Yeah. Not Higgins, but... So yeah, that was wonderful.
In English accent?
Yep.
Really?
The whole, yeah.
God, I didn't know. I missed your Eliza Doolittle. I'd have loved to have seen your Eliza Doolittle.
Well, thanks.
Because I've always associated you, for some reason, I think, because I suppose from an early age you were doing Shakespeare, right. But at the movies, and one always this thought to Claire Danes and her. She's a woman of the theatre.
Well, I actually started dancing when I was very young, and that's how I discovered acting.
I mentioned this only because the film Me and Orson Welles is particularly about getting that bug. You know, mm-hmm. Zac Efron's character comes mm-hmm. in and he's like, you know, he's kind of sucked up into the mm-hmm. stardust of it all. Mm-hmm. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, well, I don't really I just knew from the age of five that I wanted to act. I was very certain of it, and I've never wavered.
What about, I think I've mentioned to you earlier today, that Zac Efron, with whom you're in this, obviously, he's mm-hmm. a kind of massive teen idol, yeah. but it really reminded me, seeing with you in him mm-hmm. together, of the Leonardo effect. Mm-hmm. And I think he looks very much like mm-hmm. Leonardo did mm-hmm. when you made Romeo and Juliet mm-hmm. together. Do you get the same feeling that he's a young man with a kind of that explosive, you know, I haven't heard screams on red carpets like yeah. Zac Efron. The last time I heard those was when Leonardo was around.
Yeah, no, I know. It's true. It's pretty extraordinary. In some ways, I think it's even more extreme with Zach, maybe because he's a bit of a crooner as well. It's sort of like, you know, he's a song and dance man, and that is particularly thrilling for the ladies of every age.
You don't get enough song and dance men around these days.
No, you don't. Actually, there aren't very many of them. I think people are going to be surprised to discover how good of an actor he is. He gives a great performance in Me and Orson Welles. It's very subtle. And
were you surprised?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I was. I knew him as this, like, phenomenon, but I hadn't seen a performance.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely performance from him, I have to say, and I think people will be surprised mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. brave choice, in a way,
absolutely.
To kind of go in this movie. But Orson Welles, his fan base won't know what Orson Welles is. I think
right.
it's like a bank or something.
That's right. Well, hopefully they'll be exposed to him and a curiosity will develop.
You said you've just done Pygmalion and you enjoyed the experience, mm-hmm. and would you like some more? Does your film career allow you time to do much? Because I mean, obviously, you not only but have you, mm-hmm. did you you know do you do smaller movies mm-hmm. like Me and Orson Welles, but mm-hmm. Terminator 3, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't get a lot bigger than that. You
right.
you kind of managing to do some blockbusters and theatre and small movies.
Yeah, well, I have an interest in a lot of different forms of expression and storytelling on a lot of different scales, and I don't discriminate in that particular way. It just as long as the story is compelling and the character is rich and the collaborators are good, then I'm there.
And Me and Orson Welles goes on general release in the UK from this Friday, the 4th of December. And if you want to hear more from director Richard Linklater, you can catch Jason Solomons's In the Director's Chair interview at guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. And covering all the media, you can read my interview with Linklater at guardian.co.uk/film.
Tell me how the music goes around and around on a straight instrument.
Kick it.
Now, joining me to review the week's big releases is the Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Peter, this week we shall be reviewing The Box, The Girlfriend Experience, and Disgrace. But let's start with an open The Box, which is the new film from Richard Kelly. It's about a mysterious stranger who has a proposal for Cameron Diaz and James Marsden. The stranger has a box with a button, and if they push the button, someone in the world will die. But they'll also get $1 million, so I guess it's every cloud. Let's just hear a clip from The Box.
You've got blood on your hands.
What do you mean by that?
Your hands. Those blood stains.
Oh, yeah, I got into a fight tonight. Embarrassed everyone and ruined the whole party.
Somebody pushing your buttons?
Why would you say that?
Just an expression. Don't jump to conclusions, you'll get yourself in a whole heap of trouble.
Well, I'm already in a whole heap of trouble.
Peter, were you intrigued by this moral conundrum?
I was intrigued by it. I was intrigued by the basic question, where are they going to go with this? How are they going to come up with a film which matches up to this fascinating idea? And the answer is they don't. It changes the ending, the original short story ending, which has a kind of swift economical and pleasingly satisfying ending, which makes the short story click like a box indeed. Whereas this, it just goes on and on and on and on. I mean, it has no idea what to do with the idea. It is an intriguing idea. And Frank Langella, in his sort of barking mad way, is rather good. And I don't know, Cameron Diaz and James Marsden, although there does appear to be what I can delicately describe as an age differential between them, they are not bad at all. But there's so much just nonsense in it. It's as if it's like an 8-year-old who has to write an English composition and just has to keep going, you know, just has to fill up both sides of the paper with some English essay, just inventing lots of extraneous stuff. And it really is outrageously silly.
Well, you've got like the Mars landings in here. You've got mysterious nosebleeds and amputated toes.
Yes, she's got amputated toes from an accident. He's employed by NASA and yet seems to be in a position to make her a prosthetic foot. But he's employed by NASA. What possible professional expertise could he have?
He maybe needed to walk on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. He's not employed in a hospital. What possible expertise can he have in the manufacture of prostheses? Who will ever know? That's just one of a number of unanswerable questions as numberless as grains of sand on the beach, basically. It is outrageously silly. I think only M. Night Shyamalan could have done something more annoying with this film. It's one of those films in which it's a shop front without a shop. It has that fantastic idea, and it is intriguing. You know, a box with a button, they push, somebody's going to die, but people die all the time. Should we push it? Oh, I don't know. Who cares? Who cares already? Go away.
Well, what's your view of Richard Kelly, though? Because he was the sort of the critics and, I guess, the public darling with Donnie Darko.
Yeah, like eventually. He eventually became the critics darling with Donnie Darko. That was not a status or a prestige he earned immediately. That was something which I think he earned kind of retrospectively. And then we all convinced ourselves that we all loved Donnie Darko from the get-go. He followed it up with a barking mad, but quite interesting, in a barking mad way, Southland Tales, which was selected for competition at Cannes a couple of years ago. And we were all very excited by it because we thought, what is this extraordinary and bizarre sounding film which goes on for 2 hours and 40 minutes, sort of. And it was completely mad, interesting, not without value or interest, but completely mad. And now he seems to have gone with a pretty Route One sort of mysterious head scratcher, which I don't know. I think he might be one of those directors whose stock price is kind of a bear market right now. And I really don't know. I don't know how. We all thought that he had this fantastic kind of authorial identity as a filmmaker, that he would make these interesting, challenging, weird films like Donnie Darko. I know, in a way, of course, he is. But I don't know. There's something very, very perplexing about this.
Peter, let's move on now to a film by another famously wayward talent in Steven Soderbergh. And I think 2 weeks ago he had The Informant out in British cinemas. Now he's back with The Girlfriend Experience, which is, I guess, his low-budget art house project, which is a digital film about a high-class hooker called Chelsea.
I'm trying to see the role that this guy plays in your life. Not necessarily your relationship between him, and I'm not really interested in the intimate details between you, these two actual people, you and your boyfriend. I'm interested in the kind of relationship that somebody in your business would have with somebody that they actually love.
Well, let me speak with him and see how he feels about it.
Now, I see that Chelsea's played by an actor called Sacha Grey, who apparently has something like 160 film credits on IMDb. I don't know if you're familiar with her previous body of work.
I am prepared in the course of my professional duties to do some research on the internet. Sacha Grey is a very, very famous porn star, a winner of lots of porn awards, including Best Three-Way. You'll be delighted to know.
It's the one that we all want.
It's the big one. It's the big one. It's the one with the prestige, is Best Three-Way.
But you have to share it.
Yeah, it shows you're a team player. Mm.
Yeah. It's like Gosford Park with the best ensemble.
Yeah, exactly. The Girlfriend Experience, I simply don't know what to say about it. I respect and admire Steven Soderbergh. In a way, even though The Girlfriend Experience, I think, is a film which is awful, I found it pretty awful. I respected the experimentalism of Soderbergh to seek out Sacha Grey and put her in this film. But it is abysmal. It really is. Sacha Grey is a terrible actor. And I spent about 40 minutes of the film thinking, is this a sort of Bret Easton Ellis type pose that she's put on? And in a way it sort of is, but it's for real. And the idea that she could have some inner turmoil, inner questioning, that is to say, when she has to tell her boyfriend that she's going away for a few days with one of her clients and she doesn't know whether she, in fact, is it as it were a Richard Gere, Julia Roberts thing, or is she really going to be this guy's girlfriend? The idea is that she has to somehow suggest some inner turmoil or conflict, and Sacha Grey is utterly unable to do this, utterly unable. I just have to say next, please, from Steven Soderbergh. And I'm sure the next thing out of the pipeline is going to be really interesting and really good. But this,
What is the problem with him, do you think? Do you think he makes too many films? He doesn't have enough of a filter in terms of what he does?
I don't think it is a problem. I don't think he's got a problem. We've got a problem. If we want to sit down and watch The Girlfriend Experience, then we, the audience, we have a problem. He doesn't have a problem. He's a brilliant, productive, prolific, fluent guy who can just make films. He can just snap them out. Good luck, because as we've discovered a recent interview in our paper with Richard Linklater, pursuing a career as a filmmaker, director, is fantastically difficult. And Steven Soderbergh has pulled off the magic trick of actually being able to produce films as easily as writing poems, in a way. Mm. And he just, not that that's an easy business, but he's able to make these films, get them made, switch back and forth between low budget and high budget, and is well regarded, rightly so, in both arenas, in a way. So I don't know. It's just, if you produce as much stuff as he does, some of it isn't going to be very good.
So this is a misstep as opposed to a downward trajectory.
I think it's a misstep. Yeah, I just don't think it did. I don't think he is interested in this as a. It's not like, as it were, Mike Figgis. He doesn't want to pursue it and develop it and refine it. He will be back next week making something like Ocean's 11 or something like that. I mean, that's his style. That's his style.
Okay, Peter. Now we'll look at Disgrace. Disgrace is an adaptation of the prize-winning novel by J.M. Coetzee. It stars John Malkovich as a shamed Cape Town professor who takes refuge at the farm of his daughter Lucy. And the film hinges on a brutal home invasion that has unforeseen consequences for all concerned. I guess this is a tale of post-apartheid South Africa, in which the sins of the past impact on the present, and where the white landowners are forced to reassess their relationship with their black neighbours. Now, we'll be talking to director Steve Jacobs later, but for now, let's listen to John Malkovich in action.
What do you want the statement to contain?
An admission that you were wrong.
I've admitted that. I'm guilty.
There's a difference between pleading guilty and admitting you were wrong.
And that would satisfy you? An admission I was wrong?
No. First, Professor Lurie must make his statement, then we can decide if we can accept it. See if it comes from the heart.
From the words I use, you can see if it comes from the heart. Very well. I took advantage of my position. It was wrong. And I regret it.
Peter, I guess the million-dollar question with adaptations like this, was it as good as the book?
In my opinion, no, it wasn't as good as the book, but it was a very good attempt. It was very high-minded and respectful. It was a very careful film adaptation. And all those things, although admirable in their way, prevented it from really catching fire in a way that the book, I think, catches fire. With the benefit of hindsight and perspective, we can see how the story of Disgrace is governed by a fictional fad for stories of political correctness, especially in the Academy, explored by Philip Roth in The Human Stain and The Dying Animal, both of which turned into films, various types of film. And Coetzee, rather brilliantly, ups the ante. Because in sort of, as it were, Clintonite America or late Clintonite America, there's not much at stake or very little at stake other than the personal catastrophe of a brilliant but cantankerous, as it were, white academic. Whereas Coetzee shows that in post-apartheid South Africa, he can use that character to crank up the stakes terrifyingly high for the politics of race and sex in modern South Africa. Those are very high indeed, much higher than in the United States, much higher. And he is able to create this extraordinary, apocalyptic, quasi-Old Testament story of somebody's utter crushing. He's able to use this as a kind of almost tacit rebuke to the forces of political correctness, saying, well, you know, here it is. I'm able to to flip things on their head. Here is a white man as the victim. All of these things contributed to making the original novel a very controversial novel in some ways on its home turf. And even now, it is still pretty cordially detested by the ANC, Coetzee's disgrace, for these reasons. I think John Malkovich is pretty sound casting. He's, in a way, one of the few actors who could carry off the role of the arrogant white professor who conducts an affair, a pretty charmless and cold affair. He never seems particularly in love with the mixed race student that he seduces. He doesn't have any real relation with her or real connection with her. And Malkovich is good at suggesting the arrogance and self-destruction. But it has to be said, John Malkovich is a big gun. He's like Sean Penn. You cannot roll him on without hearing that booming gun go off.
Yeah.
And the mannerisms.
And thinking, there's John Malkovich.
There's John Malkovich with his huge mannerisms and huge style. And sometimes that gets in the way because it is very John Malkovich. But what can you say? You can't wheel him on and expect him to go off like a pop gun. He is a massive, you know, weapon, and, as it were. And you've just got to take it on the chin. That's how he's going to be. His South African accent comes and goes a little bit. Sometimes he forgets to do it and you forget to listen out for it. And then suddenly when he goes back into it, you think, oh, yes, oh, my God, he's supposed to be from South Africa. Jessica Haynes is very good as his daughter.
Yeah, she was great, wasn't she? And a French actor I wasn't familiar with, I mean, Eric Ebonet, who plays the pivotal role of Petrus, who's the sort of black sharecropper who's now coming into his own.
His enigmatic, unreadable attitude to the white man next door, who's come, as it were, bringing his bad luck with him, bringing his bad karma, bringing the weight of centuries of shame and disgrace. He's somehow brought that with him, and somehow inseminated this farm with his own terrible destiny. His black neighbour is partly a participant and partly a kind of choric observer, but a choric observer whose pronouncements are almost entirely enigmatic. So, yeah, everything about it is perfectly good, but and I really don't see how it could have been done better than that in some ways. But like a lot of films which are concerned to do the right thing, there is something a little hushed about them.
One thing that puzzled me about this is it's getting such a limited release. I mean, this is, it's got very good reviews so far as I can tell. It won a big prize at Toronto. Mm. It's, you know, a classy adaptation of a classy book. Normally, these sort of films would have the Oscar push.
Yeah.
And this is sort of dribbling out unnoticed.
It is. It's very strange, isn't it? And I really don't know what it is. I think it's because, in a way, it's admirable in a way because there's no Hollywood ending to it. It is a dark ending, although softened a little bit, I have to say, that the ending, the tone, the note of reconciliation between father and daughter is perhaps not quite what Coetzee wanted. But there's something so basically uncompromising and unprepossessing about the narrative itself. And it could be just simply South Africa is not sexy. Post South Africa is not sexy. Hollywood understands South African stories when they are about race and redemption. They usually juxtapose a white man and a black man and have them...
Who become friends.
And the horrible realities of racial difference are miraculously dissolved in the idea of friendship, usually male friendship, between a white man and a black man. That's how Hollywood understands South Africa. South Africa is a bad thing. Apartheid is a bad thing. Getting rid of apartheid, dissolving it, abolishing it, surpassing it. Those are all good things, and they create the warm, euphoric sugar rush of an ending that Hollywood understands. Disgrace offers precisely none of this, and that's why I think it's just not, it's not being very well liked.
Thanks to Peter Bradshaw for all his reviews, and if our two-way left you wanting more, you can read all of Peter's writing at guardian.co.uk/film. Disgrace is a tense tale of modern-day South Africa by the Australian actor-turned-director Steve Jacobs. And I'm joined now by the man himself. Steve, welcome to Film Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, Steve, the author J.M. Coetzee is a Nobel laureate and Disgrace won the Booker Prize and is generally regarded as one of the great novels of the age. So Did you see it as a naturally cinematic work, though?
Absolutely. What we felt was that the book moved us both intellectually and emotionally, and we felt that if we could get the intent of the novel onto the screen, that would be fair enough. Otherwise, if you don't believe, if you're attracted to something and then you try and sort of break it into another medium, we don't believe that's the way of going for it, because then you potentially destroy the qualities that were in the initial form that it was.
I guess, though, that there's a natural difference between literature and film, that in literature, the book is really David's story and we're seeing it through his eyes. But then when you open it up to cinema, it becomes the daughter, Lucy's story as well. Were you kind of aware of her having more of a voice in the film?
Well, I see that actually it becomes everyone's story more than just Lucy's. It becomes the girl that he has the affair with at the college. It becomes Lucy, it becomes his ex-wife, it becomes Petrus's story, because our interpretation, when you move into cinema, you can see into the performances, subtexts that give them fulfillment that may not happen in the book.
Tell me about the casting of the film. You've got John Malkovich as the disgraced Professor David Lurie, but I was reading that you were initially going to have Ralph Fiennes in that role.
That's correct.
He bowed out because of what was it, a scheduling problem?
I don't know why he bowed out. I mean, he did The Constant Gardener, and perhaps he thought that was his African story. But I don't know why he bowed out.
So what did Malkovich bring to the part for you?
Well, you know, John's a wonderful actor, but in particular, I thought he suited this role because he was unapologetic about what that character did. And you need a performer who is willing to go into territories that may not be sugar-coated for an audience, territories that are confronting, that question people's prejudices. And John had the experience and the ability and the courage to go there without, in a way, saying, please like me.
Now, you shot this on location in South Africa, but there's no actual South African money in there at all, is there?
No, we tried for years to get South African money involved in the film. In fact, we were eligible for the foreign rebate in that country, but for whatever reason, and the government department decided not to give us that as well.
What do you think that reason was? Is it, there a suggestion that
I'd say it's political?
Yeah, that the material is just a bit too thorny and controversial for them to approve.
I didn't think it was part of their South African tourism campaign.
Mm.
And I felt that they were uncooperative and dishonest.
Do you think that this is a story that they just do not want to look at then?
You'd have to ask the government department how they feel about it. All I can say is that we ticked all the boxes. They used the guidelines to keep us out of the rebate. You know, this is an art house film. It had a small budget. It was very difficult to raise finance on difficult subject matters like this. But I feel that we feel quite betrayed by them, because it showed their wonderful skills in their film industry, which the crews have and the actors have, and the wonderful landscapes. And we felt that we did our part of the bargain and they reneged on theirs.
I mean, Disgrace, the book, and I guess the film as well, has inevitably been read as an allegory of post-apartheid South Africa, which is, you know, scarred by its past and forced into this sort of uneasy compromise in order to survive. Is that how you view the film and the book?
No, I viewed it in a much more universal sense. When I read the book, I felt a universality about it, which could be in Northern Ireland, could be in Palestine, could be in the Balkans, where there is a long entrenched conflict and trauma that goes over many, many, many years. And there needs to be some type of truce between warring factions that means some type of coexistence into the future.
Do you then sympathise with the decisions that the daughter, Lucy, makes in order to find a home for herself in this country?
Well, I think that revenge is not a policy that ever works in the end. And Lucy is a great heroic heroine, if you like. I think that the choices that she makes are momentous and brave and inspirational. And, you know, you're talking... Mr. Coetzee has written a wonderful character, a character that does exist, because I've met a couple of individuals in South Africa that are similar to that. They do exist, and I'm sure they exist in Zimbabwe at the moment. She is someone that I admire for her generosity, her magnanimity. I mean, you could also say the same thing about Mandela. He didn't put his jailers in jail. He embraced them and enabled them to remain police commissioners. Mm. That type of expansiveness and sense of the future is perhaps the only reason that South Africa didn't fall into civil war immediately after apartheid was finished.
Well, Disgrace is engrossing and superbly managed, and I hope you'll make many more films.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly to discuss it.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Steve Jacobs there. And Disgrace screens here in London at the ICA and on shockingly limited release in selected cities across the UK from Friday the 4th of December. That's all we have for you this week. Don't forget, for the best news and reviews, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. Also, we're preparing our top 10 films of 2009, and we're keen to hear which movies you'd stick in the top 10. Join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans is our group, or email us directly at film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. The music featured in this week's podcast is from Richard Linklater's Me and Orson Welles, with some jazz classics performed by Jules Holland and his merry band. But for now, from me, Zan Brooks, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's farewell and good night.